Thanks very much for coming this evening, and special thanks to all the speakers tonight. John Mackey, who's going to start us off, John Bella, Anna McLaughlin and Rebecca Bell, David Marshall, Alex Frost, and I, the idea. So it's going to, the format is each speaker has 6.5 minutes, and then at the end of that we'll just go straight on to the next speaker, and then there'll be opportunity just to have some more drinks at the end and continue any questions or discussions that will come out of the presentations. So I'll let you start, John.
Yeah, I just want to apologise in advance that I have to run off after I've given my talk, as I have a deadline, so sorry I can't join in the discussion afterwards. So I'm going to start my stopwatch. My name is John Mackey. I'm an auctioneer and valuer. I work at Lion & Turnbull, which is an auction house in Broughton Place in the city. my job really is a valuer, and we value for all sorts of different purposes. We value for auction purposes. We value things for insurance. We value things for willing buyer, willing seller, for inheritance tax purposes, all sorts of different reasons for valuing things. It really depends on the client, who the client is and what their needs are. For example, if there's been a death, then the inheritance tax office needs to know what the value of the object is at the time of death. If there's been a divorce, the two parties probably want to know what the market value of their goods are so they can split it up equitably, and so on and so forth. So there's all sorts of different reasons why we might value things. So there's a valuation side of the business and there's an auction side of the business, and I'm really more involved in the auction side. And it's quite interesting to be asked to do this because I had to sort of break down how I look at an object in my head, because I just normally do it automatically. I'll just run through the various criteria that I use for looking at an object. The first thing I immediately say is, do I recognise the object? It's a big difference in valuing it. If I don't recognise it, I may not be able to realise its true value. Then I try to establish its age, the quality of its manufacture, which is related to its age often. Its rarity, is there another one? Or are there two, are there three? And that makes a huge difference to its value. There might be thousands of them, in which case the value is reduced. I then look at the object and think, is it a good example? You know, there are artists, you know, Manet produced good paintings and bad paintings, good drawings and bad drawings, and there are good pots, there are bad pots by the same artist. So I have to decide whether it's a good example of that work. I then look at the finish, the patination, whether it's been rubbed, whether the finish of the bronze has come off, which will reduce its value. Whether there's a crack in the ceramic pot, which again depletes the value. If it's a perfect example, then it makes it quite rare. Then I can put the value up. And then what's the material? Is the material intrinsically valuable? For example, is it made of silver? Is it gold? Are they diamonds? Are they glass? So silver at the moment, is the scrap value of the object more than the value of the object, the artistic value of the object? And at the moment, often, the scrap value is the higher value. And so this thing that somebody has designed and made may be melted down. And that happens, you know, every 50 years when the value of these commodities goes up, then the object disappears. But that's slightly straying from the point. The next thing I do is there a precedent for it? Has it been seen before? What has it sold for before? That's a very useful way of deciding whether something is valuable or not. Who does it belong to? Did it belong to the Queen? Did it belong to Queen Victoria? Or did it belong to Joe Bloggs? That makes a big difference. A very ordinary item that belonged to Captain James Cook, for example, might be worth, you know, thousands of times more than an object that belonged to somebody more humble or less celebrated. Is it in fashion? Brown furniture, brown Victorian furniture is not in fashion at the moment, so it's very cheap to buy, so the value of it is depressed. But in the 1980s, when anything old was revered, and Laura Ashley was in the ascendancy, you know, anything old, and you know, the people's discernment was dulled by by a need to have all things in the house, a strip pine and so on, was very valuable. Now, you know, it's difficult to give away. So that's a fashion is very important in establishing the value of something. And then, is it an established market or is it a new market? It's very difficult to value things in a new market because you're not quite sure how people are going to respond to it. In an established market, you're very well aware of the precedent of the things and what they're going to make. And also, where it is sold and what sort of reach I have makes a difference to the price. Whether I can reach the two people in the world that really want this thing or not. And I thought in the last dying seconds, actually, not at the last minute, I'd show you how I approach two different objects. This object, I look at it and I immediately recognise it. I know that it is circa 1880. I look at the decoration and I see it's very high quality, it's beautifully painted. I recognise the style as William de Morgan, who is a Victorian ceramicist of note, and he is linked to William Morris and that circle. And he creates very fine lustrewares, which he learned about lustreware in Italy at the Cantagalli factory. So I recognise it, and it's confirmed on the bottom by a stamp that says William de Morgan, Sans End Pottery. Sans End Pottery, one of his later factories, so I know it's about 1899, that sort of date. So it's a late example, not his best period. Also, I see that it's got a crack right across the top, which has been quite well repaired. So that's going to reduce a little bit. It's slightly rubbed around here. But I know that there's plenty of precedent for this because it's a slightly mass-produced piece. So I know that a perfect example like this, a late example, will make around about £1,000-£1,500 at auction. With the break, cut it down to £400-600, that sort of area. So it's an easy one for me to establish. This item, however, is a much more difficult item to value. Because there's only two of these items known. But luckily I recognised it when it came in, because the other one is in a book on the subject. It's a piece of Reamsware, and Reamsware is made in Kirkcaldy in Fife. But there's only one of these known that's thought to be in the Royal Collection, so it's never going to be seen again. It's not marked in any way, but I recognise the lead glazing. I see the cracking to the glaze, which equates to all other pieces of Reams that I've seen. So my experience is another criteria for establishing value. However, I know that the Reams market is a very established market. Most of the rare pieces are concentrated on a few collections in the world, and none of them have one of these. So I know that at least two of them are going to really want it. So from being rather an ordinary moulded object, of no particular, depending on your point of view, beauty. Queensware is a nice and honest pottery, sponge Scottish pottery. But it's not especially valuable unless it's rare. And this one is exceptionally rare. It's the rarest piece ever found. So what do I put on it? So I have hedged my bets slightly and put £5,000 on it. But depending on these two people, it may go up. And I'm going to end there. Because there is another facet to the discussion on value, and that's the selling process and what happens in the selling process. But I haven't got time for that. And I hope that's given you some food for thought.
I'm not going to introduce myself. Well, I'm from Tasmania, I'm Australian, I'm here on sabbatical. I'm just going to talk a bit about what this show made me think of. Keywords, stuff. Value, shelf life, and leftovers. On the left, you've got an Indigenous mitten, which is like a rubbish tip for Indigenous Aboriginal people. On the right, one of our bins. I'm in Darwin, I'm on a boat on the sea, and I'm with an Aboriginal guy who's emptying the contents of a pillowcase into the sea. I'm going, "What are you doing?" And he says, "It all goes back to nature, don't worry about it." So all the foam, chopped up mattress foam, is floating across the sea. And basically, why Indigenous people used to think everything did go back to nature. And now it doesn't anymore. The other thing that's come up was about our stuff. There's a question that came up with Jared Diamond, who has written a book called Guns, Germs and Steel. Essentially, he is in New Guinea. The indigenous local asks him, why have you white people got so much stuff? And then he didn't know how to answer that. But when he thought about it, it was to do with the fact that we generated ways of generating income, which allowed us to have leisure time, which allowed us to invent stuff, which by consequence allowed us to generate stuff that he called cargo. An artwork of mine, all my stuff recycling, collected for a year, wrapped up and addressed to people that lived in the city where the exhibition took place. Everything was signed. If you received one in the mail and you didn't know what it was, you'd try to throw it out. If you knew about art, you would think differently, you would value it differently, you'd see the signature, you might have heard about the exhibition, you might decide to keep it. If you're a greenie or not, you throw it in your recycling bin or you just throw it out in the normal rubbish. This is something I want to read out three times. In the ecosystem of experience and exchange, everything has an action and reaction, residue and impression. This is what we acquire, consume and or accumulate and either consciously or unconsciously leave behind. Another exhibition, I'm trying to get a cigarette from smokers to make a mark. Instead, I get a whole lot of abusive letters. I get one letter that forgets about the cultural meaning of the work, but is very interested in fiscal value. Dear Mr. Vella, are you aware that cigarettes cost 30 to 40 cents each? However, Venti premium filter tubes are about 2 cents each and come in boxes of 100. A big ballpoint pen fits neatly into the tubes of Venti king-size cork filters. There may be other sizes. Ranch filters for roll-your-own cigarettes are 97 cents per packet of 120 at Woolworths. I fear that you may, particularly if you are a smoker, be accused of running a scam. Yours sincerely. Obsolescence. Trying to buy a computer, friend keeps telling me he has insider knowledge to wait because the system is going to be updated. So he says wait because Tiger is going to be launched, etc., etc. I keep waiting. I don't buy a computer. I go to his house. He's bought a computer. He's very upset because the system he's bought just got outdated. Just this question of we spend thousands and thousands of dollars on things we know that have become obsolete. This show makes me think of that. Three ways of thinking about stuff. How do we infiltrate? How conscious are we or not of how we engage? On the left, you've got a cuckoo that's actually designed to engage and take over. The baby of a cuckoo grows faster than the resident baby. If you don't know, cuckoos lay their eggs in other birds' nests. So the babies grow faster and take over. You've got a flounder there struggling to disappear against the background. It's struggling, it's not meant to do that. And on the right, you've got a girl disappearing against the background, not actually aware of what's happening. So it's an image, a series of images about responsibility. In the ecosystem of experience and exchange, everything has an action and reaction, residue and impression. This is what we acquire, consume and or accumulate, and either consciously or unconsciously leave behind. This is my stuff, my art stuff. I've been making work for about 20 years. I've got nowhere to put the stuff I haven't sold. It sits under my house and accumulates. Thinking about this and how to reactivate it, I started to, developed an exhibition in Hobart. This is a plan of the show. In the space on the far right, everything I've made since 1996, valuable or not, was put in the exhibition space. Subject to the activities that went on in the gallery, works were selected to either sit in the office to denote certain activities, such as emails. Other works were selected to be destroyed or damaged. I'll show you a couple of office shots. The reason this is here is because it undermined my value system, how I saw the artworks that I've created. It put the very crap things that I've made in the same context as the things that I thought were very good. context where they could be destroyed, it changed their meaning and their value. In a nutshell, at night, I activated the work. When people came to the exhibition space, they looked in through a window. The works that were selected were dropped from the ceiling and put into a situation where they could be damaged or destroyed. In the ecosystem of experience and exchange, everything has an action and reaction, residue and impression. This is what we acquire, consume and or accumulate, and either consciously or unconsciously leave behind. Thanks.
I'm Anna. I'm a teaching associate with the department of what was the Department of Geography in the University of Strathclyde at the moment. If I was to get on my soapbox, I would say that there's plans to shut down the department, so if anyone's interested in that, we can speak about that at a later stage. I prepared this talk and with Rebecca Bell, who's sitting here tonight, so it's really quite scripted.
Okay.
So this talk is about how action on climate change is being used to sell an image of Scotland and also to market Scottish products. It links to works in this exhibition, in particular Feral Trade, which is simultaneously a brand, but also it's a satire of a brand, so the satire would be of fair trade. It looks at Scotland's relationship with the United States, this is one expression of that, and connects with aspects of the soapbox. So Scotch whiskey is featured strongly, so cheers everybody. Okay. So there's lots of images associated with climate change, but because climate change concerns everybody on this planet, related logos often portray the world in some way. So in this case, the hand symbolises the human, so the individual, and it thus links the scale of the body to the global scale. So the micro scale, so that would be the body or the person, to the macro, the rest of the world. But the role of the hand in this case is ambiguous. It's both destroyer and carer, although in either case it signifies human dominance in some way over nature. Okay. In response to growing concern about the environment, many groups in Scotland have engaged with debates about how to tackle climate change in some way. Engagement also enabled groups to raise their own profiles and map Scotland to new audiences. And recently groups joined forces, and this is an illustration of all those groups, to create a coalition to lobby government on climate change. And that coalition is called Stop Climate Chaos Scotland. In 2008 and 2009, the activity of this organisation was directed at pushing the Scottish Parliament to develop world-leading climate change legislation. And that eventually took the form of the Climate Change Scotland Act 2009. And the Act is world-leading in its greenhouse gas emissions reduction targets. So that's emissions like carbon dioxide, which I'm sure you've all heard of in the press. Scotland set an interim target for emissions reduction of 42% by 2020. Rather than the UK's 34%. Okay. The figure of 42% by 2020 puts Scotland ahead of the world. However, why 42% rather than another rounder figure, say 40%? Is it because 42 is the ultimate answer to life, the universe and everything? Now actually, this is closer to the truth than you might imagine. The day the Act was passed, the Minister for Transport, Infrastructure and Climate Change, Stuart Stevenson, remarked, "Let us also remember that the answer to everything in the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is one that is relevant today. That answer is 42. So, was Scotland positioning itself beyond the global and towards the cosmic? The planning timeframe to 2020 is similarly symbolic. The phrase 2020 vision and being used to imply clarity of purpose. The Act came out in advance of United Nations climate change negotiations in Copenhagen in 2009. Reflecting this 42% target, the Scottish Government delegation to Copenhagen was titled the Low Carbon Mission. So a mission, a word with a strong relationship to colonialism and Christianity, expresses Scotland's world-leading, but also perhaps world-saving ambitions. Mission also relates to the mission statement, or perhaps the missionary position, which is described as the number one favourite position for couples all over the world. The reason, maximum body contact and being able to gaze into the eyes of your partner. Two ministers, so it's the First Minister, Alex Salmond, but also Stuart Stevenson, and 10 officers embarked on the Scottish Government's mission. However, because Scotland is part of the UK, so just the upper part, as you all know, it had no official place at the summit. So it wasn't there in Scotland, it was just part of the UK. But this didn't stop Scotland organising its own fringe event, just a few subway stops away from the United Nations meeting. And that was to discuss just how world-leading the Scottish climate change legislation was. To emphasise the world-leading action and to set Scotland apart from the rest of the UK, Stop Climate Chaos Scotland used the national symbol of Scotland, whiskey, and they got 470 bottles of this whiskey, 2020, made. It's 42% proof. And world leaders negotiating action for climate change in Copenhagen, which included Arne and Obama, each got a bottle of this whiskey. Scotland's First Minister used the whiskey to profile Scotland. As the Guardian newspaper noted, hard-pressed UN climate change negotiators have been running on coffee during their late-night sessions in Copenhagen this week. But the First Minister of Scotland, Alex Salmond, offered a fresh beverage today, a bottle of specially distilled 2020 whiskey that's 42% proof. The strength of the alcohol is determined by Scotland's emissions reduction target, one of the most ambitious in the world. But Salmond said state leaders would only get a bottle they delivered to comparably bold pledges. So he said, so this is Alex Salmond, that every world leader who commits to ambitious targets will get to 42% proof. Those who water down their target will get watered down whiskey. Okay, so there's quite a lot in that statement about the whiskey. Whiskey is a symbol of Scotland, but it's not an inclusive symbol. As an alcoholic drink, I would say generally favoured by men, although some of you may argue about that. It alienates a large proportion of the population. It's only suitable for adults, and it takes a long time to age. So that could indicate a mature adult approach to climate change. However, taking whiskey or alcohol in general can be construed variously as playful, subversive, or downright evil. So, for example, the US version, whiskey, with an extra E, in particular, is linked with the devil. So linking climate change action with the devil could pollute the suggestion of the Christian mission, perhaps, by implying sobriety, seriousness, and perhaps goodness can be put aside. I suppose there's other issues within this. Alex Salmond likened watering down emissions commitments to watering down whiskey. Is he accusing the leaders or barmen of the rich nations of cheating the planet? Or is he attacking the masculinity of those who don't take action and suggesting that they can't drink their whiskey neat? Is Salmond accusing those who don't take strong action on climate change of being unmanly? And where does that leave Angela Merkel? Maybe just that thought. Okay. Climate change is one of the many environmental topics, so this isn't an isolated example. There's a lot of environmental topics that are being used to profile Scotland on the world stage in this way. There's lots of world-leading legislation being put out. The previous inertia of the US has meant that they're being targeted in an attempt to get them to take action. And using Scotland National Drought to talk about climate change links decisive action with manly qualities. It's memorable and playful, but it runs the risk of creating mixed messages. Thanks very much.
Okay, good evening. My name is David Marshall from the University of Edinburgh, and I'm going to talk today about what I call island shopping. This is a chance to talk about some work that I've been involved with Laura Nisbet and Joan Dawson at the University of Edinburgh. And I've titled it because it reflects, I think, some of the themes that are prevalent this evening. I think at a political level, by way of background, there's clearly some commitment to providing access to safe, healthy and fresh seasonal produce. But any discussion of food access requires us to think about food and in terms of retail. At one extreme, we've got food deserts, specific areas where communities do not have access to affordable, healthy food. And I think it's clear that while most of this work is taking place in urban areas, there's some debate and discussion about the existence of food deserts. It raises some interesting questions. At the other extreme, when we talk about food, we've got the ubiquitous supermarkets and the increased concentration and power of the multiple grocers. And while some research has shown that the presence of supermarkets does provide, in many cases, more choice and cheaper prices, the relationship between the presence of a supermarket and food choice and diet is much more questionable. And indeed, our work raises some questions in that area. So we started off with funding from the Food Standards Agency, and we built a food retail map of Scotland. What we found, perhaps unsurprisingly, was that large food shops were centred in the central belt and main areas of population. When we looked at availability of healthy foods, we found relatively good availability in the nine areas that we looked at, but there was some variation in terms of price. Now, one of the things that this main report didn't do was it wasn't able to tell us very much about what people thought and how they reacted to food choice and the influence that food choice had in terms of their particular decisions. So we actually undertook some work whereby under studentship, Laura Nisbet, our researcher, went out and actually spoke to people who live in one of those areas where food prices are higher, that remote area of the Western Isles. On the basis of the early part of the work, we were able to map out the location of food stores we can see here across the main road networks over the two islands. And I think one of the things our work had shown was that the mix and the type of retail format has a really important impact in terms of what people chose. We know, for example, that there are 60 food stores on the island, of which there's one large supermarket. There are four medium or general stores, but it's predominantly characterised by small general stores and specialist outlets, for example, butchers, bakers, and so on. So one of the things that we were interested in was thinking about how this impacted on people's choice. The first thing to say was that location was key, and in many cases we know, for example, that where people live in relation to those retail stores has a major impact on their choice. In many cases, shopping routines have to be integrated with domestic and work routines. Transportation was a key issue. Where people relied on public services or local buses, it was much more difficult to coordinate their shopping routines with their travel plans, particularly where there were tourists or particularly where there were issues around late deliveries and so on. A number of people had cars, but in many cases this allowed them to outshop, to shop outside of the local area. And in many cases these trips, sometimes to the mainland, were used to stock up on particular items, in many cases combining that with a family holiday or visiting friends or relatives. So outshopping was important. Most of the shopping took place in supermarkets, but there was a strong affinity and a sense of loyalty to local shops. In other words, there was a case of use it or lose it, and indeed a particular affinity to community shops where those were available. What were some of the reasons for this? Well, in many cases what we found was that people liked the local shops because of the good service. I should say that the level of service was highly variable across the stores, but good service often meant knowing what your customers wanted, providing variety and good quality produce, in particular fresh produce. Well, as I say, it was highly variable across different shops. Having said that, there were alternatives to accessing food in retail stores. And I think in a part of the country where we've got a tradition of crofting and a tradition of farming and fishing, people were very aware of some of the alternatives and some of the local produce that was available. Some of those alternatives include producer sales, buying direct from producers or buying from farmers' markets. And in many cases, this allowed people to access fresh, seasonal, local produce and to get some of their favourites, like the maca potatoes, which are associated with the region. In other cases and in other areas, particularly if people had access to gardens or to land, they would often grow their own vegetables or indeed, in certain cases, rear their own livestock. And in many cases where this produced a surplus, they were able to trade that for other products or, in some cases, other service. So barter was part of the system of food exchange that took place in the islands. Related to that, where there was surplus, we also had a situation of gifting, where in certain cases, as one woman said, everyone shares whatever they've got, because usually you've got so much of things. In fact, it's a very old custom, and this was one of the ways in which food circulated within these particular communities. So what do we find? I think the first thing we find is a coexistence of the conventional and the alternative retail. Rather than competing with the conventional retail stores, in many cases, these alternative food networks are actually complementing and supplementing what already exists in terms of food access. I think the second thing to note is that in many cases, whether it's shopping at the local shop, using the farmer's market, or gifting food, that there's a strong sense of the social and the importance of the social which interacts and overlays the economic transaction. There's some degree of mutual regard between the producers and the retailers and the consumers. And I think finally, we find that individuals are particularly resourceful and somewhat pragmatic in dealing with the challenges of island shopping, utilising a number of sources to access their food. In some cases, and related to this session, this might be seen as feral in the sense that much of the food access sits outside of the conventional channels, it's transparent and it's immersed in the community, with retailers, producers and consumers collaborating and addressing the specific challenges of accessing food in this remote part of Scotland.
Bit of a change of style, but I'm just going to talk about one piece of work. I made it last year, and this is where I'm starting. Well, there's a story that's behind this work, which is this is a painting. It's by Laszlo Moholy Nagy, and it's one of his telephone paintings. And there's a story behind that he, in the 1922, painted a series of, depending on where you look, between 3 and 5 paintings at varying scale in porcelain enamel that were ordered over the telephone from a commercial signmaker. So using a set of coordinates and a colour chart, he communicated with the sign maker all the kind of elements of this work, which are, well, using these kind of variables of the stripe, the singular band down the this sort of third of the image, and the two crucifixes. And it's this kind of interesting thing that this work, sort of, which was shown originally in Berlin, sort of came and then sort of disappeared off the radar as a kind of significant body of work in his kind of canon. And it wasn't until the 60s with the kind of generation of American artists that it sort of got really sort of discovered. And so in reference to that, I made a mural, which this is a detail from, and the mural has every part of the mural is bought online from a shop, from a retailer, or exchanged. From the various kind of systems that are available. So there's a long list of websites that I'd gone to, and it was down to the sort of board and, you know, just everything. And there was a kind of theme that there was a selection process involved as well, which I'll talk about a little bit later. And so another element to this, to that, another kind of influence on that particular piece of work, that mural, was the idea of these, what kind of known as outsider environments or environmental sculptures, that this is one example of it's the Watts Towers in Los Angeles, and over a period of 30 odd years, a man called Simon Rodia built was essentially an empty lot in a sort of rundown part of Los Angeles, a series of towers, and also live within that structure. And what was interesting for me was the way that he would travel the area collecting material to apply to this one project. So there are a number of other examples of similar kind of projects, and they all kind of generally sort of fit sort of format in that they're usually a male concern, a one-man project, an individual's project, hence the kind of fantastical, and the fantastical element of that is possibly to do with the kind of scale of the task undertaken. And they often involve someone who's from fairly humble origins and also maybe is considered either mad or an eccentric. And this is another example, but in a rural location in the Droma area of France, near just south of Lyon. And it's called the Ideal Palace, or the Fractal Cheval, by a man called Ferdinand Cheval, who was a postman. And so he would sort of go around the. So he would go around the his location, picking up rocks that he wanted to use in his grand plan. The elements of that were the large structure that I just showed you, which involved simulations or reconstructions of Swiss chalets, Hindi palaces, and other sort of structures in stone. And the interesting thing about that is, at the time, kind of reproductions were coming into common currency, and so he had access to these things that were previously not really seen. So. I took for the mural that I made. I took the wheelbarrow and sort of took that as being the ultimate sort of emblem of those kind of projects, and sort of took the internet shopping cart as my own. And that the pillow that I've just shown you is the pillow that these people are sitting on, and within the gallery that this was shown, internet access was provided to people who with a password. So the work itself is on the scale of a mural, and also kind of to a certain degree that sort of relates to it being public space, and it is a public space in that it's in a public gallery. And essentially it was made for a fictional swimming pool, and also has this sort of unfinished element sort of written within it, and there's a repetition of a logo which is not necessarily complete. And each of the elements is always about the ephemeral or the invisible. So all of the imagery depicted has a kind of watery swimming pool like imagery. It also references Wi-Fi, which is an airborne radio sort of invisible element. And also there's also the elements that make it up, which are all sort of bought from a variety of retailers, but all relating to water in some way. So I'll show some details later. Oh, yeah.
So in reference to the sort of idea of the environmental sculpture, this is a fairly recent trend map of the internet in the style of the New York subway. And the weather symbols are actually more in reference to the work, to the health of that particular website. And so instead of taking the landscape around me, the available landscape, I was taking I was a very static version of the Land of Wheelbarrow. And this is a kind of Tolkien art version of the same thing from a couple of years back. It's a slightly closer version, and you maybe I don't know if that does anything. So you can make out here some artificial coral that's bought from an aquarium supplies, a series of stones and shells, as well as tiles that incorporate shelled animals and some slightly ridiculous sort of glass and plastic elements that are stuck on that are intended for fish tanks as well. And as well as that, there are elements like, which you can just about make up on, making out like this one here, which is like about to, hopefully that's left over here.
Try to be good.
I try to think about a way to imagine knowledge in this room.
I is rebounding from the walls and come back to eyes, ears. I are all here.
Is an experiment in neural activity? Or is that just a bad analogy with what we might think of being as a knowledge economy? Are they the same thing? But do you think the way we did it before, in the past, where we try and break that, like, and now I've broken that, and I feel like that's just completely contrived, and I know you knew I was going to do it, even though I didn't tell you. are we giving a product of some sort? Or like, are I giving a product of some sort?
I fulfill his expectations.
I have the same brain. Because that's what I'm trying to do.